you needed to reduce?
It is absolutely increase in high level. They increase a lot. Every day you will go to supermarket, 10-20p every single day almost.
At more than 19%, food inflation here remains at the highest levels in over four decades, meaning an even greater squeeze on the budgets of low-income families. One of the drivers of inflation, new research shows, Brexit.
What is clear, and I would agree with that, is that Brexit has lowered people's living standards. All right? We voted for this nonsense, and now people are beginning to regret it. But it's a little bit too late.
The government admits the costs are getting out of control and is working with food producers, farmers, and supermarkets to explore ways to reduce the pressure on households and to find out if middle companies are taking out too much profit. Trade unions say higher costs are not trickling down to the workers. While there have been strikes and higher pay settlements with some sectors, the gap between people's pay and price increases is substantial.
What's happened, of course, is this year people have taken wage rises that are below inflation. That means that their living standards are falling. So next year, guess what? They're going to try to catch up. And that's why it's going to be more persistent than a lot of central banks thought and a lot of people in the markets thought.
The UK's central bank has increased interest rates 12 times now to try and tame inflation. But the rate is still higher here than in all G7 nations. And that has meant more people falling on hard times. Today, one in seven Britons is skipping meals due to the rising cost of living.
So many people not being able to afford food or having to skip meals is a sobering thought in a wealthy economy like the UK's. But that is the reality of the inflation crisis and of post-Brexit Britain. Saeed Pariza, London.
For the last two decades, Afghanistan was a war zone under the U.S. occupation, and Afghans faced violence, insecurity, and poverty in that era. Also, free media paid a heavy price for reporting the truth. On May 31, 2017, a truck bomb killed more than 150 people near the German embassy in Kabul. Among the victims were three Afghan media workers, including Press TV's cameraman Habibullah Hussainzada. 5 years on, his colleagues and relatives remember him as a brave and dedicated professional.
Mata Hussainzada was a very kind-hearted and brave person. He dedicated himself to the society. Habibullah was passionate and committed about his career. He loved journalism ever since he was at school and got a job at a local media office. Then he enrolled in university in journalism and worked with Press TV to become the voice of the voiceless.
Hussainzada was not the only Press TV worker who lost his life in Afghanistan during U.S. occupation. Syed Farhad Takaddusi was another Press TV media professional who died in line of duty. According to the Afghan Journalist Safety Committee, nearly 150 journalists and media workers were killed in the country between 2001 and 2021. Rights bodies blame the U.S. occupation for creating a climate of bloodshed and impunity.
Of course, the United States and NATO war on Afghanistan took a lot of lives from Afghan civilians. Journalists were among those thousands of innocent victims who lost their lives in a war they weren't involved in. Unfortunately, in the past 20 years, none of the killers of journalists were held accountable. The U.S.-backed government and judicial bodies intentionally and unintentionally ignored the cases.
Despite the risks and challenges in Afghanistan under the U.S. occupation, Press TV was one of the main media outlets that covered the most underreported stories and gave an alternative perspective from Afghanistan. These are the faces of Press TV's fallen heroes in Afghanistan. They sacrificed their lives to bring truth from a war-torn country. They will never be forgotten by their families, friends, colleagues and viewers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Resistance Festival in Brussels has gathered Palestinian rights campaigners from across Belgium and beyond. Israel's murder of innocent civilians and the regime's ongoing illegal activities in the occupied territories has been highlighted.
The Nakba has been going for three quarters of a century now, and we're talking about brutal colonialism and occupation in its most ugly form imaginable. Yeah, people are angry.
Apartheid, ethnic cleansing, segregation, siege, all forms of ethnic cleansing and colonialism. The Palestinian political prisoners also.
Tel Aviv authorities continue to destroy Palestinian homes and develop stolen land for settlers. Activists are calling on everyone living in the EU to stop buying Israeli products.
Yes, I think there should be boycotts, I think there should be sanctions, I think there should be punishment.
I think it's absolutely vital that we continue to support them in their struggle against fascism and imperialism.
We are here, helpless and hopeless sometimes, we feel. And we cannot protect our people in Gaza. This is painful, very painful.
Even though the United Nations classifies Israel's activities as illegal under international law, the EU seems to suggest that both sides are to blame for the occupation.
We are consistently urging all parties to exercise maximum restraint and not to contribute to escalation, but to the contrary.
When it comes to the war in Ukraine, there is no such mixed messaging from the EU. Russia has always been the only aggressor, end of story. Rights campaigners say Palestinians will be free eventually, insisting it's simply a matter of time.
Given that the European Union is so willing to impose sanctions when it falls in line with the wishes of the United States, those gathered here are calling on EU leaders to finally muster some courage and put Israel under real pressure. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has won another term, garnering 52.16% of the vote. Right after the announcement of the runoff results Sunday night, opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu thanked the 25 million Turkish citizens who voted for him, especially youth and women, and promised to continue the struggle for democracy with his alliance.
The means of the state has been entirely pledged to one person. I could never stay silent when your rights were violated. I could never tolerate you becoming second-class citizens after millions of refugees came here. I fought for all this and I will continue to fight.
For her part, Good Party leader Meral Akşener congratulated President Erdogan on winning a new term and called her supporters and those who cast their vote in favor of the opposition candidate not to feel pessimism or loss, assuring that election is the most fundamental display of democracy.
Don't forget that we are still here at the parliament. We will continue to fulfill our responsibility. I want to congratulate Mr. Erdogan for being elected, but he should not forget that the polls conveyed messages to him as well.
Akşener delivered her speech from the Good Party headquarters in Ankara, rather than the area opposition alliance designated to celebrate their victory in the case of winning. Analysts believe the only reason those six political parties agreed to nominate one candidate despite their ideological differences is to gather their efforts and oust Erdogan. And with that not achieved, the nation alliance is likely to be divided.
I think in the coming few days we may see divisions and resignations in the Turkish opposition, especially that the table of six gathered unseat President Erdogan. On the other hand, I think the People Alliance and ruling AK Party will be facing a lot of challenges because Turkey is already struggling with economic crisis, the refugee crisis and some problems with the neighboring countries. The People Alliance must work harder now that they will govern the country.
More than 25 million Turkish citizens voted for opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. This election had been seen as Erdogan's biggest challenge, for the Nation Alliance was very close to unseating him. Now that the presidential run is over, political parties have already started preparing for the upcoming local election in 2024, with Erdogan promising his supporters a win in both opposition strongholds, the capital Ankara and the economic hub, Istanbul. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, the Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards non-violent protesters. Many of France's yellow vests were glad the subject was reported upon, but the group which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Chaque samedi, bientôt cinq ans.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the yellow vests have been in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make our legitimate demands for democratic and economic rights, and we won't stop until we get them.
Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 yellow vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries.
The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely, and will likely scare many away from even observing a yellow vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy, why the yellow vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a 2-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
Pour leur physique de venir en manifestation.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest now. There are so many arrests, so much violence, and constant tear gas. This is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, the yellow vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France, and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media, because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Al-Quds International Institution has held its annual meeting of the Board of Trustees in Damascus. The meeting was attended by Palestine's ambassador to Syria, Syria-based Palestinian factions, and Syrian President Assad's political and media advisor, Buthayna Sha'ban, who is also board secretary in the institution. She called for the unity of the Arab and Islamic world in order to liberate Palestine. She set the case of Syria as an example for Palestinians that victory is undoubtedly the result of steadfastness.
Arabs have returned back to Syria. The difficult experience Syria went through for over a decade is a beautiful lesson for Palestinians that those who believe in their cause the most will triumph. President Assad's presence in the Arab League summit is not just a victory announcement for Syria, but also signals the failure of huge plots made by strongest world powers.
Speakers highlighted the heroic resistance of Palestinians in the battle codenamed Revenge of the Free in the Gaza Strip. They called for confronting Israeli attempts to Judaize Al-Aqsa Mosque, reiterating that Quds will remain the eternal capital of Palestine. The meeting comes following an Arab League summit and reconciliations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Syria and the Arab world. Such developments, according to speeches delivered, indicate that the world is heading towards a multipolar system where the West's hegemony is demolished. Speakers underlined the importance of reminding the world of the Palestinian cause and the suffering of the people of Palestine caused by the Israeli occupation. Despite the decades-long Western double standards, institutions like this believe that Palestinians' steadfastness will eventually lead them to restoring their rights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
UN bodies issue fresh warnings about the impacts of huge fan gaps in Afghanistan. The latest such warning comes from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Afghanistan, which says urgent funding is needed to avert an imminent large-scale humanitarian catastrophe. Afghan experts are also worried about funds drying up and the international community turning its eyes from the war-torn nation.
Definitely, the only way out of the Afghanistan crisis is constructive engagement between the ruling Taliban and the global community. This year, hopes of heeding Afghanistan's appeal for financial aid are fading, and it is very threatening. Shortfalls in funding absolutely deal another devastating blow to the Afghan nation, especially the most vulnerable citizens. We will witness more poverty, unemployment, and devastation in Afghanistan if funds continue to dry up.
The United Nations has launched a humanitarian appeal for $4.62 billion to assist nearly 24 million Afghans in 2023. However, the appeal has received very little support so far, with only 6.4% of the required funding secured. This has forced many aid organizations to scale back their activities, leaving many without help.
Aid cuts are a disaster. People like us are eyeing international assistance. We have no job and income, so relief aid can be a lifeline for us. Some are sick, they need free treatment. Some are in dire need of food and cash aid. People will die in their houses and on the streets in the absence of global aid. They have no money for themselves. First, they are relying on God's mercy, and second, on the relief aid.
Major aid cuts, Western sanctions, and the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. are exacerbating Afghanistan crisis. Afghans have been calling on the U.S. to release the funds and to lift the sanctions, saying they are hurting and punishing innocent people who are already suffering from poverty, famine, and hunger. Afghanistan is facing a severe funding shortfall that threatens the lives of millions of Afghan people. Aid agencies warn that the global community must act urgently to prevent a humanitarian disaster. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepest me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russia's special military operation in Ukraine has taken a new turn with drones to attack Russia's capital, Moscow. Whether from Ukraine or Ukraine-inspired, this increasingly shows that the Ukrainian side is eager for the war to continue. At least that's what it's showing. While Russia has called these drone attacks acts of terrorism, it comes on the heels of Russia's increased attacks in the capital, Kyiv. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at where this war is headed to and what plans do the backers of the war have in mind, the U.S. and NATO. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Glenn Diesen, professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway, joins us from Oslo. Also joining us is Rustam Safronov, who's a political analyst, Lucia Segodnya, joining us from Moscow. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Glenn Diesen, I'll start with you. So let's start out with what Russia has been doing in the past month. 17 air attacks is what we have so far. I don't know if this is relevant, but it's happening mostly at night. Ukraine says that they're intended to sow fear and to wear down air defenses before an expected Ukrainian counteroffensive. But the real question first comes is, why is Russia attacking the capital, Kyiv, so much more in the past month or so than prior to that?
Well, my main interpretation of this would be that Russia has previously avoided excessive attacks directly on Kyiv, but this is seen as another step in the escalation as Russia's responding to its red lines being crossed. So first, of course, the Western countries began to send tanks, which was a red line. Then the British were sending ammunition with depleted uranium, another red line. Then the British are again sending long-distance weapons. And now the latest one is, of course, this F-16 deliveries. And on top of that, Ukraine attacked the Kremlin with the drone. So drones are plural. And so this is the main reason why I think Russia is also responding in kind. But beyond the retaliation, I think there's also the mere effort of destroying the military capabilities, and as you mentioned, especially the air defenses of Ukraine, as both the Ukrainians and the Russians are preparing an offensive each. So I think this is the preparatory work in order to destroy military hardware and, of course, open up the skies so the Russians will be able to use their air force to a greater extent in this coming offensive.
Okay, well, trying to figure out, Rustam Safronov, what your analysis is on the attacks by Ukraine or Ukraine-inspired attacks that involved the drones. One analyst has said Ukraine attacking Russia is the quickest way to lose the war because Russia hasn't even started to really act seriously and to militarily use its full capabilities. What is your reading into why Ukraine is choosing this time to use drones, in this case in point, in Russian soil?
I think it's a preparatory measures from Ukrainian side for counterattack, which planned and prepared long time ago, and everybody is waiting for that. West, Ukrainian forces waiting for go ahead and start a counteroffensive. And of course, Russians. So they're trying to use drones attacks on Russian capital as a some sort of psychological weapon, trying to show Moscow it is vulnerable, the same, almost the same as at Kyiv. We're trying to bring a war in territory of Russian Federation, and maybe we'll take over part of your territory in Belgorod region, and after this we'll try to do exchange of the territories as a, some sort of preliminary measures for peace and so on. So it's part of psychological warfare as well as a military.
Well, Glenn Deason, I'm not sure if you can help us militarily look at what we have experienced, what the world has been seeing for the past months, ever since, or it's been longer than that, since this special military operation has taken place. In terms of the military equipment that has been provided to Ukraine and the progress or the expected progress that was anticipated for them to make, I mean, just from the outside looking in, when you take a look at the Ukrainian territory, I mean, some of the places are destroyed. But when you take a look at what's been delivered to them, like long-range rockets, you heard a lot about HIMARS, for example, or the howitzers, or the anti-tank weapons that were given to them intermittently, and as you mentioned, then the F-16 fighter jets, are we looking at them making enough progress for them to want to continue receiving these military equipment and with the expectation that there's going to be some kind of a win on the battlefield? Is that one reading into it? Or what are we looking at here?
Well, I don't think so, because, well, there's no evidence of it. Keep in mind, at the same time as the West, crosses these new red lines by delivering increasingly heavy weapons, it always coordinates with Russia having increasing its advantage. And even you see in the media now as well, in the Western media, especially the American media, that there's a effort to downplay the effectiveness of any coming Ukrainian offensive, pointing out that Russia has the upper hand. So I see it as quite different. I think when Ukraine has had its forces destroyed and its military equipment destroyed, and the NATO sees the advantage is going excessively to Russia's favor, NATO effectively is faced with a dilemma. Will they see Ukraine lose, or will they escalate by crossing another red line, delivering a more advanced or and a weapon system, which increasingly involves NATO in this war as well? So I think, that this is the main reason why NATO continues to cross these red lines and deliver always heavier and heavier weapons. Because the common slogan or rhetoric every time there's another red line being crossed is that this will be a game changer. So obviously, the game is looking to be changed. You know, we're looking to change the tide, which then implies that things are going Russia's way and we have to turn this around somehow. So I think that the losses on the Ukrainian side is the main reason why NATO's feeling forced that it has to escalate.
Okay, Rustam Safronov, give us your reaction to what the German defense minister Boris Pistorius made recently when it came to providing supplies to Ukraine from Germany. He said that stopping arms supplies to Ukraine would mean an immediate end of Ukraine. And his quote was, the end of arms deliveries means the end of Ukraine tomorrow. And so he says, of course, we have to deliver weapons as long as it takes. I mean, is that, what do you think about that? Does that mean that if they stop, do you agree with him, that Ukraine will cease to proceed with the war, that it won't be able to?
Well, in the beginning of special military operation, Russian forces are capable in a relatively short period of time destroyed most of the plants of military industrial complex of Ukraine and their ability to repair their own weapons. So, of course, after that, since the military operation didn't succeed with a victory in a short term, was capable to provide new armament for Ukraine, new weapons, and so on. And right now, of course, it's crucial for Ukraine to receive this military help. Without that, Ukraine wouldn't be able to sustain whatever, any, maybe a week or two or three, but anyway, short period of time only. So obviously, right now, Western alliance, United States and NATO took a position. They have to fight and help Ukraine to fight as long as possible and make Russia to bleed and weaken Russian army, infrastructure, and economy with being involved in a full-scale, long-time war, not just short military operation, but bloody war, and that's the main purpose. And right now we have some kind of situation. Nobody could have a decisive victory in a short period of time. So that's what we have. And so far, no any political decision on horizon with ending on that conflict.
Taking a look at what the U.S. stance is on this, I'd like to figure that out from you, Glenn Deason. If what Joe Biden said regarding the Ukraine assistance still holds, where he said the famous word or phrase, whatever it takes for as long as it takes. I mean, do you think that's still the way that Biden thinks about this assistance that it has to provide for Ukraine, that it has to go all the way out, even as we're looking at what we're looking at right now in terms of the landscape?
Well, from the American side, they had the objectives been stated very clearly for a long time, which is, as the other guests suggested, to bleed Russia. I mean, there's a report by Rand Corporation from 2019, which most are probably familiar with, written for the U.S. Army, ordered for the U.S. Army. And this is, you know, this outlines a strategy, which is essentially pull Russia into a conflict. This is favorable, as it can help to drain Russia of its resources, both economic and military, and also isolated in the world. And as we've seen, once the war began and Russia and Ukraine attempted to find some settlement, it was the British and the Americans who pushed hardest against any efforts by the Turks and the Israelis to find any settlement, which has been confirmed, so effectively sabotaging any peace. And again, Biden has on several occasions, as well as the British government, suggested the goal should be to have regime change in Moscow, that Putin has to go. You have key Republicans such as Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, Dan Crenshaw, and others arguing that, you know, this is a good war for them because, you know, they have now the position to, the opportunity to effectively bleed Russia. They can weaken and defeat and or weaken an adversary at least without losing any American soldiers. This is what retired U.S. General Kellogg said as well, that this should be considered a good war because, again, They can try to weaken Russia significantly without using any Americans, and then America can focus on China instead. So I think that the objectives have been, while it's not always been made clearly official, they've been quite obvious or open about it from day one. Even the Lloyd Austin, the defense minister, who's very openly said that the objective of the United States is to weaken Russia. So it's not a big secret anymore what the objective is. So I think if you can prolong this war for as long as possible, keep it going, and have a forever war draining Russian resources, it would be in American interests.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, trying to figure out how the U.S. can actually reach that goal, Rostam Safronov, when you take a look at, for example, Russian oil sales to have peaked, have reached a new peak for this for the month ending in April, and when you take a look at the fact that, the economy is not as getting battered the way the U.S. would ideally like to, which shows somewhat the inefficiency of the sanctions that the U.S. has actually incurred but not received the results that it wanted. So what kind of economic damage is the U.S. looking for when it can't achieve it up to this point?
Well, they're looking the purpose of the goal to weaken Russia as much as possible. Yes, so far Russian economy is sustaining quite well, doing not bad under the circumstances, and probably have some reserves. But we have to consider overall West has much more solid economic potential than Russia by itself, especially necessity for Russian military industrial complex to carry that burden alone without any literally significant foreign help. So additionally to everything else, it's a human cost, which is, extinction of a human capital. That's the most dangerous and horrible things what happening to that war. So obviously the West decided to get involved in that long-term exhausting war and just wait who will blink the first. Obviously them. Right now, when both sides could not achieve decisive purpose, the best decision would be to look for some political solution. But before any of the side would achieve some kind of decisive victory in a battlefield, nobody wants to start negotiations. Just both sides not ready because they both feel they can succeed militarily most of the purpose. So that's the bottom line.
Well, in terms of what's happening, let's bring in the Donbas region, Glenn Deason. What is happening in that region is basically you have Russia obviously defending that that area, but it's also the people and the residents of that area who obviously are aligned with Russia. Why is it that Ukraine believes then that Russia is going to give up that territory when it especially comes to the four regions where there was a referendum that was held, and people voted for Russia. Obviously, that's just not going to happen. What idea, except for the Ukraine thinking military can push Russia back, but then what is it going to be left with, even if that's done, in terms of the citizens who prefer Russia over Ukraine?
Well, it's difficult to say how they're going to be able to incorporate this entire region under Ukrainian control, even if they were able to defeat Russia on the battlefield. But of course, this is important strategic region as well. There's a reason why the United States, for example, prioritizes getting Russia out of Crimea. This is also the reason why Russia annexed Crimea in 2014. It's where the Black Sea Fleet is. It's very strategic territory. If the Americans could kick out the Russians from Crimea and ideally replace them, the Black Sea would become a NATO lake, absent of any real Russian presence. And so there's a lot at stake. And furthermore, you have a lot of the Ukrainian now Russian Black Sea Black Sea coast, which is quite important for logistics. You have some of the best soil in that region. There's a lot of natural resources, the industries which have survived. I mean, there's a huge economic potential in that region. So there's all the incentive in the world to try to reconquer it. But the main problem is they're not going to be able to get it in through negotiations, because for Russia, there's two reasons why they would never surrender the Donbass again. And that's the first is, of course, the people who live there, because it's been, well, it would be very difficult for Russia to pull out now after, well, the media effectively and the government said that they will protect the people who were bombed and shelled for 8 years. But possibly even more important would be the strategic territory in terms of military, because if this territory was absorbed into NATO, it's deemed to be an existential threat. Again, this is something that's been confirmed by top politicians in the United States, CIA directors, that Ukraine into NATO would be an existential threat to Russia. So it's quite important for Russia to prevent that and effectively create a buffer or take over the territory east of the Dnieper River. So I just don't see how they can get the objectives they want. And I think that's been one of the weaknesses here in NATO, which is, you know, talking about defeating Russia. What does it mean? Taking back Crimea? I mean, I think we're going to have nuclear war before that would happen. So we haven't really defined what victory means. So I think it just means to bleed Russia. I think that's it.
Well, since you brought the nuclear topic in here, Rostam Safronov, Putin ordered a special service regime, as it was called, in Russia's deterrence force, where he said the strategic deterrence forces, they can use, various types of weapons, which includes nuclear weapons, for any aggression against Russia. Are we still looking at that being a possibility when it comes to this special military operation of Russia on Ukraine?
Probably. If Ukrainian would be capable during the counteroffensive operations split off of Russian troops through Melitopol and Berdyansk and attacked Crimea and step in the territory of Crimea, who knows what could happen? I wouldn't be surprised if Kremlin and Mr. Putin decided to use a tactical nuclear weapon. But hopefully things didn't get to that point. We can just only hope. But obviously, if for Donbass and for Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, still big fight going on. Crimea is already Russian territory, even after reunification for quite a while. And obviously, people have zero associations with Ukraine. Meanwhile, I have been a few months ago in Donbass, and I talked to different sort of folks there. I can tell you, If Ukrainian would be able to grab the territory militarily back, almost all people have to be evacuated out of there, because it will be main ethnic cleansing, because they do not want to live under nationalistic Ukrainian regime, most of them. And especially now, after many months of shelling and whatever, being killed by artillery, Ukrainian artillery, they're really angry now. So it's going to be fight before political solution would come, and hopefully things didn't get close to Crimea, and nuclear weapon not going to be used. But if Crimea would be touched, anything is possible.
All right, let's take a look at Europe as a whole in terms of its citizens, Glenn Deason. Do they have a role to play when it comes to this whole war in terms of how they're suffering economically, when it comes to general finances, which has been basically described as a cost of living crisis that many Europeans are feeling? Not that it's just because of the special military operation of Russia, but for example, one poll says that Europeans want peace over war, and they worry about the cost of the economic sanctions and the threat of this nuclear escalation. Do you think that the leaders of European countries look at their economy and how battered it is and is getting worse, that may lead to them to think twice about the type of support they're giving, not the type, but the support that they're giving Ukraine and whether to try to go for a negotiated solution?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's the weakness in this plan for a long war against Russia. I mean, from the United States perspective, it's fine. Their weapons manufacturers and their energy companies are making an absolute killing, so they're doing quite well. The weak spot here, or weak point, is obviously the Europeans, because this was also not really predicted that the Europeans would suffer this greatly from the sanctions they imposed on Russia. So you have then especially Germany suffering the greatest, because it has a lot of energy-intensive industries and it have been reliant on Russia, and also exporting to the Russian market this finished product. And this is not just Germany. I mean, Germany has been the economic locomotive for Europe. So the Europeans are struggling economically greatly. We have depleted their weapon storages. There's still a great concern about this new conflict with Russia, which is why the Europeans are continue to listen to Washington and continue to commit themselves to sending more and more weapons. But I don't think it's durable. I think the economic pain is making people a lot more critical of the war. More people are looking for diplomatic solutions, increasingly as the economic turns sour. So I think this is the main weakness. This is what would prevent the goal of a long war effectively.
Thank you for that. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Glenn Deason, Professor of International Relations, University of Southeastern Norway. Thank you, Rustam Safronov, Political Analyst, Russia Segodnya from Moscow. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vetäway and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
The West's attempts to pressure Africa to turn on Russia have failed as people on the continent realize that the unipolar world order is coming to an end, according to the head of the Russia-Africa Partnership Forum. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Newsweek, Oleg Ozarov, who is also Russia's ambassador at large, said recently that the attendance of 40 out of 54 nations at the Russia-Africa Interparliamentary Conference had shattered the myth of Russia's alleged isolation due to the events in Ukraine persistently promoted in the West. People in Africa understand very well that the former Soviet Republic has turned into an arena of confrontation between the new and the old world paradigms, between different visions of the future. Not just a trivial feud between neighbors, he said. According to the diplomats, the well-balanced and neutral approach towards Russia's confrontation with the West by Africa, China, India, and Latin American nations confirms once again that the transition to multipolar architecture is irreversible. Those countries clearly understand that the time for unipolar world order is running out, he added. What Africa needs now is promotion of local solutions and national interest, as well as deliverance from the rigid constraints of globalism promoted by neoliberalist ideologies, Ozarov said, adding, African countries count on Russia's support in achieving those goals. Moscow is backing efforts to complete the decolonization process in a number of African countries, while also working to put together a broad anti-terrorist front on the continent, free from any hidden agenda or double standards, the diplomat continued. The US and EU want Africa to play the role of a mere supplier of raw materials to the civilized world, Ozarov said. But Russia has a different approach, as its primary interest is to assist the development of Africa's domestic energy and electricity markets, where we have considerable expertise, especially as regards nuclear energy, he explained. Moscow has no vested interest such as to preserve its zone of influence or aggressively guard markets from any outsiders, and Africans see that, the envoy said. And that's the reason why the unprecedented pressure by the West on Russia's partners in Africa is not that effective in practice. Ozarov said that during his trips to the continent, it became obvious to him that the aggressive imposition of Western new values causes growing rejection there and only brings Russia and African countries closer together. Russia is due to host a high-level Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg in July, with the envoy saying that recent developments indicate that the event is going to be a success. Meanwhile, RT reported, the West has been hampering the growth of African nations, who are now turning to the East. Bistrat Meles said, Africa is benefiting from the emerging multipolar world in which the continent is building relations with Russia, China, and other BRICS nations. Bistrat Meles, a senior producer and news anchor at Ethiopia's Fana Broadcasting Corporation, has told RT. Meles pointed out, now the time for unipolarism has ended. Now is the time for multipolarism. This multipolarism is great for African nations and an opportunity to tie with Russia, to tie with China, to tie with the whole of the East.
Moscow offers cooperation on equal terms to African nations, while the West is executing its own agenda, interfering in internal matters of the Africans, he said. Institutions such as the International Monetary Fund, IMF, the World Bank, which have been active in Africa in recent decades, are the ones executing this agenda of the US and its allies, the journalist believes. According to Meles, the creation of the BRICS group, which unites Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, has opened up an opportunity for the continent to obtain alternative sources of financing and speed up its development, he said. Now China and Russia clearly create the opportunity for African growth.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.